What's going on, y'all? Rock M. Sabri here. I cover financial trauma, financial empowerment for people who look like me. Came across a video that kind of inspired this. Basically, there was a guy who was talking about how you cannot worship the ancestors and Jesus at the same time. And then there was a woman who stitched his original TikTok with a TikTok of her own, talking about how, as Black people particularly, we have a responsibility through these platforms to share accurate information regardless of what our personal views are, where I agree with her. However, where I disagree with her was she went into the whole thing about how we are not worshiping the ancestors, we are respecting the ancestors. And this is in line with like African traditional religions. And so I said, that's really interesting, you know, the power of words. I decided to go and look up the definition of worship and reverence. And interestingly enough, worship and reverence are synonyms of one another, or they're used kind of interchangeably. Worship had been labeled as being kind of outdated, whereas reverence is more more relevant. And so, it's really interesting. I go and I comment under her post that the definition of worship and the definition of reverence to say that there is nothing wrong with worshiping the ancestors, right? Then I was like, man, like this could spin in so many different directions. And I started to think about this series, American Gods, which is a book turned into a series by, I don't remember the author's name, but basically the idea behind this concept of American Gods is that we give power to the things that we believe in. We give power to the things that we believe in. And what is the thing that all of us believe in, right? What is this thing that, when you talk about the value of all of these things that we invest in, whether it be the stock market, whether it be cryptocurrency, whether it be just the US dollar and the power, the global hold that the US dollar has on world economies, it's really fueled by this concept of belief. And so my question to you is, do we as a global culture and specifically as a US culture, and then even more specifically as a Black culture, do we worship money? And as we think about the answer to that question, then we can kind of open up the conversation around how does placing this value through worshiping of money impact or influence or perpetuate financial trauma? Certainly, I think that it does, right? Because when we place so much value on money, right, this idea of money, and I think a lot of people they get caught up in looking at money as just this one-dimensional or this two-dimensional thing, right? It's a transactionary. It's the fuel for what we have these transactions, right? I give you money in exchange for product. I give you money in exchange for service. I give you money in exchange for time. Or I spend my time in exchange for money. And people will create their whole existence around this idea of the acquisition of money, right? So in a way, by giving so much energy, so much of our physical energy, so much of our mental and emotional energy, so much of our spiritual energy to money, we kind of become, and this is going to be an interesting kind of divot, we become worshipers of money, or we become slaves to money. And through the servitude to money, we then, by default, become worshipers of money. So we're placing money on this very high pedestal, almost as if money is a deity. And there are some people, there are some spiritual practices that view money, or that view monetary arrangements through the lens of spirituality, in that there are deities that represent money. Pulling back the layer of that statement into this question around how does it perpetuate financial trauma, as we value or place value on consumerism, right? As we place value on the wearing of our wealth or the demonstration of our wealth through the cars we drive and the clothes we wear or the accessories that we have on, or the locations that we get to stay at, and what are the amenities that come with that locations. And I'm not shaming anybody for doing these things, right? I like nice things. If I travel, I want to be comfortable. I don't want to be in a shack that, you know, has a hole in the ground for a toilet. I want running water. I want hot water. I want electricity. However, there is like this theme, especially with social media, powering the glamification of what success looks like financially or through the lens of entrepreneurship or just through the lens of being a human being, right? This whole rise of the influencer. Well, what does that mean? Who are these people influencing you? And what makes them, what puts them in a position to influence over anybody else? And as I've gotten into this space of creators, right? And I'm intentionally using the word creator rather than influencer. The term influencer has been used as applied to me when it comes to this content, because it is hugely influential. However, there are people out there who, like, their whole life is social media. I mean, you look at the rise of the Kardashians, right? They're the influencers. They're like the original influencers, right? What is the foundation of what their success looks like? It's all centered around money. I do know that there's this concept within our communities around money being the root of all evil, right? The often misquoted scripture of money being the root of all evil, in that people very quickly will correct me and say, no, it's not money being the root of all evil. It's the love of money that is the root of all evil. And most times it's boiled down incorrectly, right? It said money is the root of all evil, and we internalize that as, some kind of internal shame, mistrust, guilt, cognitive dissonance as it relates to existing in this state of lack or poverty. When it comes to overcoming the boundaries or the obstacles, rather, that exist in living a life of wealth, but then when we get to a point where we live a life of wealth, then our focus become, and this like concept of selling your soul to the devil, does this then become centered around the acquisition of more money, more money, more money? So this is a deep topic, and it can go in so many different directions, because I think not having money perpetuates financial trauma. I think having money perpetuates financial trauma. And it's really the value that we assign to money through our beliefs, through our practices. What is it that we're sacrificing? What is it that we're giving up, particularly as it relates to time, in order to get money? And then what is the thing that we're looking to accomplish in getting money? So I was reflecting on my own experience in corporate America and leaving corporate America this morning, actually. And I said, to myself, I started working when I was 16 years old, and I was working because my mom told me, like, go get a job, right? It's the conversation that the parents have with their kids. And I think a lot of times, like, that knee-jerk reaction, go get a job, is to keep, especially coming out of minority communities, urban communities, especially if they're rougher urban communities, is really stay out of trouble. Right? Go get a job so you can stay out of trouble. Go get a job so that you can build skills that make you marketable so that you can go and get a job somewhere else. And so it's this laddering, right? I get this level of experience and I can do this thing. I get this level of experience and I can do this thing. I get this level of experience and I can do this thing. But I realized as I was reflecting today that I only worked because I thought that was the thing I was supposed to do, right? Like, there was no goal tied to that. And as I listened to conversations with other entrepreneurs around, financial freedom and what that looks like for them, what is the purpose behind the work that they do, or the work that they did to get to a place where either they're eliminating massive debt or they're buying into real estate or they're investing in the stock market so that they can achieve freedom, the lines of similarity in all of those experiences are that they're working towards some purpose. And so as a child at 16 years old, at, you know, I mean, I know there's people who start working at 14 years old, but, you know, in those ages of your early teens or late teens where you're working, oftentimes we're told to go to work without there being a solid strategy or a purpose or a why behind that. And so we learn at a very young age then to worship money because, well, I've been working since, I'm 32 years old right now. I've been working since I was 16 years old. I've been working half my life. Like, that's crazy to think about. I've been working like literally half my life. And for what, right? Just to get a paycheck. And so I think as these conversations happen and we talk about financial literacy, the importance of financial literacy, which I agree, it's very important. And we talk about entrepreneurship or being work optional, right? Not having to spend your time or backbreaking hours in a space where maybe you're mistreated or undervalued or just viewed as kind of a cog in the machine. We also have to like start talking about purpose and using purpose as a compass to direct the choices that we make, particularly as it relates to money, so that we can avoid some of the traumas associated with money, whether that is not having enough or making it and constantly feeding into this idea of more. So I know I'm jumping all over the place right now, but bringing it back home, right? Reverence or worshiping of money and how that perpetuates financial trauma. When we, we look at situations even in the media, in the news, where a lot of these rappers are getting killed or robbed and killed in order to, not in order to, but because of the wealth that they display, which is characteristic of the industry, right? In order for you to be hot, in order for you to be lit, you gotta have like the jewelry, you gotta have the cars, you gotta have XYZ, and it incites this spirit of envy or this spirit of this coveting spirit that says, he has it, I want it. And so I'm very careful too, as my platform grows, to be very honest with people and not flaunt or portray that I have it more than I do. And certainly if I do have it, I don't want everybody to know that I have it, right? And so I made a TikTok turned reel maybe last week or so, where I was talking about how I discovered that people are actually Googling my net worth. Like if I start to type my name into Google, it'll say Rakim Sabri net worth. Like, Google will assume the answer to that question, which is the indication to me that people have searched it. The services that I offer are not offering financial advice, right? I'm speaking about the mindset. I'm speaking about your relationship with money. I'm speaking from a place of education. I'm not saying, oh, if you listen to Rakim Sabri, this is what you need to do. And it's funny because again, scrolling TikTok, I spend a lot of time consuming content on these platforms. This particular account came up because I searched financial coaches. There's a black guy, financial coach, 200 some odd thousand followers, and I'm scrolling through his content. And I come across a video where he says, if you listen to me, you are going to be able to do that, right? Big commitment off rip. And I'm like, wow, that's dangerous. And so he's like, if you click the link in my bio, you will get this whatever step, plan, path to whatever, right? And so he goes into different plans. He's like, first, what you need to do is open up a bank account. And then you need to do, and he's like going through these steps. And I was like, man, like, this guy, because financial coaching as an industry is not a regulated space, so you do not have to be certified to coach. This guy is going and doing the exact opposite of what a coach should do by giving these blanketed pieces of advice to everybody, to 200,000 plus followers, and telling them to do XYZ so they could click the link in his bio so that they could get access to his download, so that they could probably add it to his funnel, so that they could probably be marketed to around his course and his coaching product. And I'm like, man, like, people have really learned how to turn this into a hustle. But beyond turning this into a hustle, they're now there is now dangerous misinformation or dangerous approaches to sharing information that says, this is the way that you do it. And if you follow this way, you'll be successful. So I'm scrolling through a dude's page and I'm seeing him like in a pool at whatever, like using the lifestyle marketing, you know, just full lifestyle marketing. And I'm like, if I was not me, if I was like just a consumer or somebody who wanted to escape their situation and I came across this piece of content, I would be tempted to follow through, right? I would be tempted to listen to this guy. I would be tempted to do whatever it is that he says I need to do. And then looking at his social proof, you know, with the number of followers, et cetera, I would be like, this guy is it. Like, I need to, he's a black guy. He looks like me. Like, I need to be following him. I need to be doing what it is that he's doing. Where me as the financial educator is looking at his content and I'm like, man, that's irresponsible. That's financially irresponsible, right? Shout out to the book, Financially Irresponsible. And in that, it's also the perpetuation of trauma. It's the perpetuation of financial trauma, because if I then did follow through with his plan, right, and it didn't work, well, then his argument could be, well, you didn't work hard enough. Right. So then there's guilt and there's shame associated. Right. Or his argument could be, well, personal finance is personal. So like you're backtracking on your commitment to getting me to be able to save XYZ dollars or be able to, you know, basically mirror this lifestyle that you are articulating or perpetuating in your background. But I think for those who really, really at the bottom of like the gutter, right, the who are struggling and desperate, can look at his content and be like, that's a target, right? So then again, it inspires this feeling of, not this feeling, it inspires this spirit of coveting that says, I want what he has and I want to cut the line, right? I don't want to do the work. I deserve to have what he has. What makes him better than me? What makes I've struggled enough. He already has it. It's mine for the taking. I'm gonna go and take it. And I think that attitude is, or that the spirit of that coveting, is not talked about enough in this space. As we look at people who use lifestyle marketing to sell their course, to sell their product, and there's too many people, including Mr. Rich Dad Poor Dad, right, who have made millions off of the product that they sell and not the information that they're supposedly selling, right? Robert Kiyosaki did not get rich from real estate. He got rich from his books and his courses. And so we see repetitions of that over and over and over again through social media with these influencers. And I'm not saying that there's anything wrong. Please don't misunderstand me. I'm saying that there's anything wrong with building a course, selling a course, buying a course, right? I've created courses. I'm in the process of creating a course. I think it's absolutely brilliant that we live in a time where we can share knowledge and we can monetize that knowledge in a meaningful way to make a difference in people's lives. Where I think that there's a problem in this environment of coaches and courses is that the marketing around the coaches and the courses are creating unrealistic expectations for the audiences that makes it difficult for people who, like me, want to approach this space of education from a place of integrity, right? From a place of, I have information that you might want or that you might need, and I deserve to get paid for packaging this information. To put a course together is not free, so I at least deserve to get paid for the amount of money that I've invested in creating this course or this program. But I'm not going to sit here and sell you, you know, gold during the gold rush. That's not there anymore. And so, you know, marketing is psychological, money is psychological, like trauma is psychological. I think there's an ethical way to do all of these things. And the ethical way is often the harder, more challenging way. And I'm speaking from experience, right? As a coach, as a course creator, as a content creator, that, and you know, the integrity that I have does not allow for me to market my successes as like, here's the magic pill that you buy and you take and you're gonna become Rakim number two, right? If you listen to me, you're gonna end up buying a house in 6 months. If you listen to me, you're gonna end up having 850 credit score in 6 months. If you listen to me, you're gonna end up, you know, being able to save XYZ dollars and duplicate the gains in the stock market. Because the reality of the situation is that no amount of information that I share, based off of my personal experience and the knowledge that I've acquired over the course of this time that I've studied and been in the space, is going to change your life if there are not certain situations aligned to make that thing happen. I recently came to the conclusion that although my success, and I'm using air quotes for success, right? Although my success has been self-directed, my success has also been dependent upon the support of the people in my environment, right? The people that I've surrounded myself, the team that I've built. My success has been dependent upon timing, right? So what is the current environment as it relates to rate, as it relates to credit, as it relates to income, as it relates to inflation, as it relates to just being in the right place at the right time? And so the last thing that I'll say is my success has been dependent upon getting lucky, right? Striking gold. And I was raised to reject this notion of luck, right? Luck does not exist, right? Coincidence does not exist. And I still maintain that positioning. I used to get offended when people would call me lucky. But I also realized that when, you know, to kind of make this a little bit more scientific, when you look at probability and chance, right? You even looking at, you know, flipping a coin, right? There's no way for you to guarantee that if you flip a coin 100 times, that 100 times it's gonna land on heads, or that 100 times it's gonna land on tails. But you add more than the two variables of heads or tails. You add the variables of what poverty looks like. You add the variables of what income looks like. You add the variables of what age looks like. You add the variables of what being a black man looks like. You add the variables of what education, the timing that I've received that education versus the timing that I've been able to execute on that education looks like. You add the variable of location and what that looks like. The house that I ended up buying to change the trajectory of my future and the future of my family at 26 years old was a part of an estate, right? So I was able to buy my house for significantly cheaper than what the market was offering it for because somebody died. I just want that to sink in. The timing around me being able to purchase the property that ultimately changed the direction of my life and the life of my families was possible because somebody died. And that's not to say that if this property, if I didn't end up buying this property, right, that I would not have been able to go on to buy other properties. But I was able to buy this property because somebody died. It was a part of an estate. So they were very motivated to get rid of this so that they can settle the estate and pay off the heirs. And because of that, I was able to acquire the property at a particular price point. And since then, over the last 6 years that I've owned this property, experienced massive appreciation and value. Because any house that I would have purchased would have appreciated over this time, right? But massive appreciation and value, which in turn opens up other opportunities because somebody died. Probability, chance, timing, you know, all, like looking at it from a scientific perspective and saying, I just happen to be in the right place at the right time. I happen to undertake this goal at the right time. Because if I hadn't started taking the steps 3, 4, 5 years before, to get to a place where I was ready to execute on this opportunity, then somebody could have died and the house could have been $1, but I wouldn't have been in a place to acquire that. And so when I think about this concept of luck, yes, it's offensive to think that, you know, somebody waved the magic wand and I was able to get this opportunity that somebody else wasn't. But when I think about this concept of being prepared to take action in a situation where I'm in the right place at the right time. Well, that's my responsibility, right? That's my accountability. So going back to this idea of like worshiping money and the trauma that it causes, for anybody who's listening or for anybody that will listen, it's very important for us to define what success looks like for us financially. I think it's very important for us to define what money represents, because money is a symbol. Money is not a thing. Money is a symbol. It's representative of something, right? Money is a piece of paper. So when we define what money represents to us, and we define what success looks like for us, we can then learn how not to worship money, how not to revere money as a deity, but how to look at money for what it is, which is a tool, and then how to use that tool to position us for what success looks like in the way that we define it. And so, does success look like owning a mansion to you? Does success look like having a pool in your backyard that you never use? Does success look like having a garage full of exotic cars? Does success look like wearing, you know, jewelry? Does it look like travel? Does it look like spending time with your family? Does it look like what the, find out how to define what success looks like for you, and reject the notion that social media pushes onto you around how to be successful. Second big takeaway that I want people to have from this is make decisions and move through purpose. And if you have children, do not perpetuate the same choices or traumas that our parents perpetuated onto us, right? Especially as it relates to going into work. So if you have a 16-year-old or a 14-year-old or 18-year-old, and you're telling them that they need to go get a job, you need to tell them why they need to go get a job. Don't have them out here working for half their life until one day they wake up and have an epiphany of, why am I doing this thing? Because then they'll learn by default to place a value on money from the perspective of worshiping, in the way that we're talking about it, right? And if they are ever separated from that money, whether that be through firing, laid off, quitting, etc., accident, etc., the trauma of being ripped away from their God is going to be significant. But if you give them purpose and you tell them, okay, you need to go get a job so that you can do XYZ thing, you need to get a job so that you can buy your freedom, right? One day, through the acquisition of assets, through the acquisition of, or even if you're taking it out of the lens of money, you need to go get a job so that you can learn skills that you can bring home to start your own business, right? And I think the same logic can be applied to this idea of college too. You need to go to school so that you can do XYZ thing. Stop sending children out into the world unprepared to do these tasks when they don't understand why they're doing these tasks. That's my call to action. Give them purpose. And then the last takeaway that really kind of took me away while I was talking about it was, don't discount what preparedness looks like in the right time in the right place, right? So, you know, like I said, I don't like to use the term luck. I don't like to believe that, you know, somebody waved the magic wand and I got lucky in certain instances, but I definitely know that because one thing happened and I was in the right place at the right time, because these variables lined up for me, that I was able to make decisions or choices that ultimately had an impact, a long-term impact, a long-term positive impact in changing the trajectory of what things look like for my family. And I say that, and I said that very vaguely, but I'm gonna be very specific too. I bought a multifamily home when I was 26 years old. I moved my mom and her fiance into one of the units. I saved my mom and her fiance money on a monthly basis from where they were previously living, so that they could then build credit, save money, so that they could then go out and buy a home of their own. Because I bought a house at 26 years old because somebody died, I was then able to allow for my mom and her fiance to buy a house. Within this family structure, we have two houses based off of the decisions and the choices that I made. That's powerful. in addition to being able to provide an environment for them to build so that they could buy a house, the experience of buying a house that I was able to articulate and talk about through the lens of all of my experiences allowed for, let me just count, 1, 2, 3, at least 3 other people purchasing property because they saw through the lens of my example, through the lens of what I've articulated in telling the story through my book, Financially Irresponsible, or through the TED Talk that I delivered, right? And so I am directly responsible through the purchasing of my house. I'm directly responsible for the purchase of at least 4 different houses within my network because somebody died. That's crazy. That's crazy to think about. Because somebody died, I was able to purchase a house, which ultimately resulted in 4 people outside of me at least being able to purchase homes through my example. Crazy. Hey guys, Rakim Sabri here, and I just wanted to drop by and thank you for listening to this week's episode. Please share with your friends, rate my episode on whatever your preferred listening platform is. And if you have any feedback, reach out to me on social, everywhere at Rakim Sabri, no underscores, hyphens, or periods. Until next time, I'll see you guys in the comments.